Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Catch with John Fisher on Blog Talk Radio, connecting life to faith.
We're just trying to get it together, trying to help the fellow man. And we can make it better. Do you really think we can?
Well, good evening, everybody, and happy December 9th, 2014. It is December, and the bells are ringing, silver bells. The red and white lights are blinking. And the things are swinging into gear, not quite yet at the Fisher House, but a lot of houses on my block are starting to twinkle because we're getting close to Christmas time. And, you know, it's fitting because we've got a guest here tonight who is a co-founder of Bethlehem Coffee. So, I mean, we're going to go to Bethlehem. So, yes. How about that, Gunner? We're going to go to Bethlehem.
Yeah. I'm excited to go to Bethlehem, and I'm as excited that you just actually used the word twinkle. I mean, I could just visualize your street. I could visualize your street right now of just this twinkle. Every house and everything. And, boy, it is December. Boy, it kind of every year it seems to catch up on us, doesn't it?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Life speeds up incredibly, and I just want to stop the roller coaster somewhere here.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Well,
yeah.
Now, John, if you talk about the twinkle, I mean, it's always kind of a big deal when it's time to put the tree up in the Fisher household. It's a big deal, isn't it? I remember seeing pictures from the past. I mean, you're putting your life on the line a lot of those times when you're stringing the lights, aren't you? I mean,
well, it is. It is. It's a big deal because we always get a big tree. And we've got a very small house, probably under 1,000 square feet, but our living room has an open beam peak to it. And at its highest spot, it's 14 feet high. So
we can
actually take like a 12 or 13 foot tree. That is, if we can get it in the door. That's always a challenge. You know? And then once it's up, you know, then I've got to bring in ladders. And, you know, I've got to do acrobatic tricks, try and get stuff around the very top, tippity top of it, you know. But we try to fill up as much of that space as possible because that's just my wife, Marty, she is Mrs. Christmas. That's just her thing. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, is it kind of a tradition? Or, I mean, is there a certain way that you go about it every year as far as, I mean, is a certain way to put the ornaments on the tree and the look and the feel and just every year kind of that tradition?
Oh, yeah. The main thing is that John does the lights.
Yeah.
No one else touches the lights. Okay. Because John likes to wrap them in and around and take his time with it, you know, so that they kind of disappear inside the tree and then they just kind of show up. You know, I don't throw it on. You know, this is a very, very artistic movement. And so quite often I'm doing lights like at 3 a.m, you know, because it's the only time I can really do it, you know. And and so I put on a little bit of Christmas music, and it takes me probably about two hours to string the lights, 2 to 3 hours maybe, string the lights. Yeah.
Wow.
Once that's done, then everybody can have at it after that, you know, with all the balls and the ornaments and all that stuff.
So that's kind of
like, fun.
That's the yearly thing. It's kind of your time. You clear the channel. You get the, you know, I can almost visualize you doing some workouts. I mean, maybe watching the training scene from Rocky IV or putting on Eye of the Tiger, getting really focused, and then you just go after it, don't you?
I do. I go after it with probably, I don't know, gosh, you know, 6 to 8 strings of lights probably 100 to 150 each, you know. So, yeah, it's lit up.
I think we're overdue for another video post from you. And I think when you do get to swinging those lights up this year, you might need to just kind of invite all of us into that experience and just kind of maybe give us some pointers, give us some tips on really what's the best way and the best approach to putting a light on the tree, and maybe post a video for us.
Okay.
And we'll send it out to everybody. And maybe if you're listening to the podcast and it's still December 2014, you know, post a picture on our Facebook page of your tree and your experiences in putting up lights. Now, if you're like me, I'm spending hours, you know, trying to figure out why this string of lights doesn't work, you know, and going through that madness. But all that to be said, I think you need to invite us in on that. Maybe you need to think about that, John.
That's great.
And shoot the video.
I like that. I'll have Chandler do it and, you know, film it so that I can, you know, do a full-on demonstration of how to properly string lights on a Christmas tree.
Now, I'll tell you what, if you do that, John, and we're going to bring our guest on in a second, you do that, then maybe what I'll do is I'll put together a video, too, to kind of keep the holiday cheer together of kind of a how-to video of how to make eggnog. And we could have a whole series of these videos, John. What craziness. Anyway, we've got a fascinating show tonight. As you mentioned, we're going to take a trip to Bethlehem tonight, and maybe tell us a little bit about our guest, and we'll bring him in.
Well, Gunnar, I think you may actually know more about our guest than I do. So I'm going to ask you to tell everybody about our guest. I know a few things, but I'm anxious to hear the rest. He's a multifaceted guy. I know that. He's very artistic. I think he's a photographer. He runs, I think he designs websites. He's got a business, a coffee business going, and he's very invested in Arab Christians. And that is really unique. And I want to talk to him about that. He's an old friend of Larry Norman. Now, that's all I know. Why don't you tell me some more?
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, I've known Tim for several years now. I met Tim and his wonderful wife, Christine, through, you know, another friend when they had brought a wonderful woman over from Rwanda to speak at the Willamette University down in Salem, Oregon. And we just kind of hit it off. And over the years, we'll get together and we've worked on some projects together. Music for Libya was one of them, a music project that was helping.
I remember that.
We had Matthew, I think one of your tracks, Matthew's Blues, was on that.
Yeah.
Raising awareness for some work that was happening in Libya. But I love this man's heart.
Great.
I love his passion. And he's got probably one of the most active Facebook pages I've ever seen. I mean, there is so much awesome dialogue happening. And so there's going to be so much more that we'll unlock tonight. But I love this man. He's a great friend. And I'm going to bring him in right now, John, in audience.
Okay.
Please welcome Tim Gilman. Tim, are you there?
Hello. I'm here.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, welcome. John. How are you?
I'm fine. I want you to know, Tim, I am sitting here with a fresh cup of Bethlehem dark roast coffee.
Sweet.
I need to tell you, this is very important. I am drinking it out of my cherished Route 66 coffee mug.
That is important.
Yeah, that's really important. That gives you an idea of what I'm talking about.
How special it is. That's right.
And Tim, it's excellent.
Is it good?
It's very good. Very good. And very smooth. And none of that, you know, sharp aftertaste. It's really nice. I'm enjoying it. And I've got my Christmas Oreos to go with it right now. Yeah. So
I totally understand.
Oh my! So let's start somewhere, Tim, because you are into so many things. It blows my mind. So let's start with since we're talking about coffee, Bethlehem Coffee Company. And mm-hmm. let's find out where that came from and what's your vision for it, and tell us about that.
Okay. Well, about 3 years ago, I volunteered and lived in Palestine, in Bethlehem, for 2 months. I volunteered with an organization called Holy Land Trust. They work with another organization called Palestine Summer Encounters, which provide for long-term being up to 3 months, because that's what the Israeli government allows for a tourist visa, to go and live with a Palestinian family, either Christian or Muslim, of your choice, and volunteer and do whatever is your expertise or your passion to do, and learn the culture a little bit, and just kind of just really a super immersion kind of thing. So wow. I was there, and it was a amazing experience. And from that, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
And from that, you know, my friend Dan O'Neill, who's the founder of Mercy Corps, is a long-term friend of ours, and he was one of the guys. You know Dan? Okay. Well, he encouraged me to. Go ahead.
Is that Dan O'Neill in Nashville?
No, he's in Seattle.
Oh.
He's the founder
okay,
of Mercy
I'm
Corps.
Sorry.
Anyway,
he had
a lot of experience in the Middle East. And so he encouraged me to go. And he said, before you do much, you just got to go and be there. Because, you know, until you go and are there, you won't really get a taste of what it's really like. In some ways, it's not as bad as what they say. In some ways, it's worse than what they say. So that's what I did. So my wife happened to be over there, of course, at the same time. So she was with me part of the time. And we were there. We lived with the Palestinian family. And, you know, after about a week, I didn't feel like a tourist anymore. I just got on the bus and went to the offices like everybody else did. And so out of that, I probably two major things. I mean, I came to the awareness that there are indeed such a thing as Palestinian Christians, Arab Christians, you know, who trace their ancestry back to the day of Pentecost. They're not converted.
Wow.
They're not former Muslims. They're Christians. Largely they're Orthodox, but there is a small majority of what we would consider Protestant or evangelical Christians as well. So from there, it was just kind of okay. This feels right, because for me, in my growing up in my faith, there always was this unsettledness about war and conflict and
mm-hmm.
how it seems to all be kind of disguised or justified by our religious point of view or our view of God, or there's a whole lot of stuff there. And so I never was really comfortable. I was kind of asking those questions. So I'm not looking at Israel-Palestine so much to change them as I am to be changed myself.
Hmm.
And then in turn, hopefully reflect that to some of the people that are in my circles. And to say, okay, you know, there is another narrative here. There's another narrative of the occupation. There's another narrative of what the supporters of Israel look at as the victory of 48.
Mm-hmm.
That's also a disaster for another group of people. And as
mm-hmm.
much as on one side it's victory, as much as on the other side it's a catastrophe. Actually, that's what they call it, the Nakba. So and then trying to hold this position that doesn't say that I'm on either side. Because most of the critics on either side will try to force you to one side or the other. But coming from a position that totally believes that Jesus, in this case, Jesus stands equally for all people. And so how can you work through that? So the upshot of that was, come home, what am I going to, you know, what's my footprint? What's my niche that I can work here? And being from the Northwest, you know, coffee is like our blood. I mean, we're the coffee country. So my background is design, and so we just decided to develop this brand. And I have had a client that I already worked with that was a roaster, and he roasts for me on an as-needed basis, and we just developed the brand. And I have a partner from Saudi Arabia that's helping me do it, and provide some funding, and we just started out small and started a website and designed bags, and you know, started out from there. And so that's kind of where we're at. And we're still very small and very much in its baby stages. There's lots of potential. There's potential for roasters. There's potential for lots of stuff, but we're just kind of getting started.
Okay. Does the coffee itself have anything to do with the Middle East, or is it all in this country?
No, not actually. At this point, well, first of all, it would not be cost-effective to ship beans back and forth. So,
right.
So no, the beans are not from Bethlehem. Currently, they don't even grow beans. The closest you can get beans in the Middle East are from Yemen, and they're considered to be pretty strong towards our standards. So, this particular beans that we're using comes from a small farm in Costa Rica. The long-term plan is to have partner roasters all around the globe. I mean, I've talked to people in South Africa, talked to a roaster in Germany. We're working with developing a relationship with a new roaster actually in Bethlehem that will roast and basically use our packaging. But we won't be shipping beans back and forth. No, that's just not cost-effective. At least at this point, it's not. So this isn't so much about the perfect cup of coffee, although that's important, but it's more about what coffee represents, and coffee represents community. The coffee house is a common. It's the same reason everybody loves Cheers. You know, I mean, it's the community that's created, and so that's what we really believe is that, you know, it's a foundation for relationship building. And whether that be there, because one of our goals is to actually have a coffee house there in Bethlehem, but even in local groups here, when people meet, talk about the issues, we've networked a lot and continue to network with a lot of groups that are working around this issue. Largely, a lot of them are in more mainline churches, Episcopal, Presbyterian, some of those churches, but it's starting to spread out a little bit more. But there's a lot of communities around the country where little groups meet and talk about peace and peacemaking and those kind of things. And so coffee is kind of a natural fit. And so if people can make connection with the brand when they're visiting or when they're in the Holy Land, then they can come home and they know they can enjoy a good cup of coffee, support the cause. And so it's totally a branding concept rather than the quest for the perfect bean.
Leave that to the aficionados. Well, it's a pretty good bean I'm drinking right now.
Yeah, it is good. I'm not saying that to apologize for all. By my friend Bert,
very good.
He does a great job. So I've never heard anybody say anything bad, and it's been a lot of people that aren't just saying that to make me feel good. There are people that would be honest, and if it wasn't, they would tell me. So, no, we're real confident in that part, too.
I'm on my second cup. I've gone through four Oreos. Uh-huh. And I've still got a little bit left in my pot here. I plan it to last. Yeah.
Instead of a three-dollar night, it's a four Oreo cup of coffee.
And that's right. And it's not acidy or anything.
Right.
It's really good. It's really good. Now, here's the deal. Question. So you hope then, it's a twofold part of this question. Right? Do you hope to educate people in some way through the coffee? And second, does any part of the profit intended to go towards the Mideast or Bethlehem or anything like that?
Okay. First of all, education is primary. I don't think that'll necessarily come specifically from the coffee as much as hopefully the environment that the coffee is a part of. So if the coffee is an entrance, a way to build a relationship, then yes, absolutely. Currently, we have a project set aside where we've raised some funds towards actually working on a coffee house there. We keep those separately, and those would go specifically to the coffee house. Other than that, from the sales, just go into making it work at this point. And we're both involved with quite a bit of stuff. We volunteer there, and so but we're not like sending funds to them. No.
Okay. Now, business wise, it looks like you were kind of in business for yourself. Is that right, Tim?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And tell me what that looks like, because I know you're doing in areas of the design? What are some of the other things you do? And then I'm working towards something here. I want to know how, if at all, your faith interests that picture. You know,
my what?
Your faith. Your faith.
Oh, my faith.
Your Christian. How does your faith?
My faith.
How does
okay.
your Christian faith address that? Yeah.
Sure. Well, as we talked when we talked before, I mean, I've kind of come up through this career, if you want to call it, as a creative. Started out as a photographer. Really, you know, I had, had an art teacher when I was in fifth grade, and I can't even tell you what it was that happened, but something happened in my heart to where I realized that I could communicate creatively. And and then my faith comes along at the same time, and I was fortunate because I got out of town when I was 19, 20 and went to Bible college and got out of my little myopic church experience and saw a lot of different people, a lot of different, you know, even different denominational people and even people that were, didn't even pretend to be Christians and built some relationships with them. And so I became, it became real clear to me that, you know, that the creative, they're really all things that we think are the fivefold ministries are really creative processes. I mean, even good preaching. I mean, T.G. Jakes used to say the best theater is every Sunday morning in America. So it really is creativity. So what I, and then the other niche that I found is that oftentimes the weakest spot in most nonprofit work is their level of creativity. Either they
yeah.
don't have the funds, or they don't have the vision. Usually, it's more funding, and so this is extreme. But they end up Xeroxing stuff and sending stuff out that, you know, just kind of what I would say is kind of ugly and doesn't really show the quality level that we should be showing. So
right.
I've always had the interest of finding that right niche, and of course I've done all the other things of, you know, I mean, I applied for a job with, you know, several large nonprofits and actually worked at one for 6 years. And so it's been kind of a gradual learning from that. And it's all been the same goal to be an authentic reflection of my understanding of what it means to be a follower of Jesus. Now, I'm okay to give and other people to have a little bit different understanding. I don't require everybody to get into my box, even though I try to have a very big box. But I feel that that's an important thing. So with that said, as kind of an overarching thing, it's kind of evolved from being really a photographer to we had an art gallery for a while. Then we had, you know, then was strictly a photographer, worked for a couple of national Christian magazines. That really exposed me to the whole design process. To sit with an art director and an editor and start with a stack of manuscripts. Six manuscripts, and like 6 weeks later, come out at the other end of the table with a magazine. We did that for 3 years, so that was quite an experience of just seeing how that all worked. And of course, at that time, we were still doing it the old way because that's when the Macs were first coming out. So
right.
you know, we were doing everything the old-fashioned way. So I was doing photography that way and working with art directors and stuff, and just the whole passion for that process really, really kicked in. And so then it's just been kind of, you know, going to, I was creative director at United Way in Portland for 6 years, and that exposed me a lot of more team building types of things and how to work with teams and how do you take the information and the leadership that a board or that even executives give you and then interpret that into something that's appealing and communicate that vision to the public. We had about a $20 million a year campaign in Portland every year. So that kind of evolved. And then the other thing that's been really kind of evolving here in the last 2 or 3 years is with the advent of technology and particularly with on-demand printing, I've now done about 15 or 20 books. Just paperback books, done a couple hardcovers, working on a photo of an artistic book now. To where, you know, there's the ability for people to do stuff like that without having to go and, you know, borrow all their money from their relatives and buy a pallet of books and stick them in the garage and just hope they sell them.
Right.
So that's kind of the crossroads, that's kind of the place I'm in now. And so I kind of look for voices. And another thing, I was fortunate when I was young that I was had several people in my life that really encouraged me by valuing what I did. I mean, I remember this one little lady that her son was my best friend, and we would go to her house. And in those days when I could show all my slides at one time, you know, like maybe four reels, you know, she would want to see them all, and you could come back a week later and she'd want to see them again, you know. And it was just,
wow.
That process of having your work valued does wonders for people. So
wow.
I'm really personally more interested in helping other people find a platform and their voice. And so I look for people like that, you know, that maybe have something to say, or at least think they have something to say and want to do that. And then in the process, you just kind of build relationships with people. And that's kind of what I have done. Probably the most exciting thing I'm working on right now is, and we'll have it done by the first year, is a translation of the Quran by a Muslim who is a Muslim follower of Jesus, not a Christian, but a Muslim follower of Jesus. So that's a whole different show. And but what he's done is never, from what we've been able to tell, never been done before. He's translated the Quran, which from what he's told me, there's about 80 different translations of the Quran. They aren't quite as far in the paraphrase translation business as we are with the Bible. But what he's done is taken, and then where there is the opportunity to make connections with Old and New Testament scriptures, he's footnoted those actually in the text. So it's not going to be parallel, because parallel isn't possible, because the Quran is not a timeline story. So that's something I'm personally really excited about, to be able to see that. To see how that works. And then he told me his next idea is he's working with these other guys, Christian guys, who want to do the same thing in reverse and use the Bible as their foundation and show places where the Quran, I mean, clearly we all know there's places that the Quran and the Bible diverge, but there are many places where they also complement each other too. And so that's something that's really exciting to see that come into play. And that's the kind of project that if I wasn't out in these circles doing stuff, you know, I would never run into these people and say, you know, hey, what about this? I can do that. You know, can I help you with that? You know, that kind of thing. So,
wow.
That's kind of the way it kind of happens, you know. And
Well,
so
Tim,
the coffee's there. It's just kind of a vehicle.
Oh, Tim, you opened the can of worms right there. Boy, all those people who want to burn the Quran and all those Christians who are saying, how would you ever have anything to do with that? Why would you want to show where the Quran and the Bible are similar? What do we gain by that?
Mm-hmm.
Since I know that question's got to be out there.
You want to try
and answer it for us?
Well, the way I can answer it, I can give you my basic thoughts. My basic thoughts are that at the end of the day, the whole thing is nothing more than sibling rivalry. Basically, they're all descendants of Abraham, and they've been fighting since day one. You know, I mean, since Sarah basically told Abraham that Hagar had to go. I mean, I'm not a theologian, but from what I can kind of grasp here, I think that the Arab people have always been the other. You know, they've been the people on the other side of the tracks. You know, they've been over there. It's like, so you can imagine Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the special people, if you want to say that, or the chosen ones. And it's like, you know, they're over there. Those are those people. And even when we get down to the point of Christianity coming along, because it was totally within the Jewish story. I mean, Christianity developed out of the Jewish story. They still were the marginal people. So I think an argument can be made. Maybe I'm not a theologian, but it seems that, you know, I think in lots of ways Muhammad just wanted to matter, and I think he appealed, which oftentimes happens with some of these guys, they appeal to marginalized. And so if we would understand, if we include people, we take away that element. But if we make divisions and say I'm in and you're out, then of course if they have some idea, there's a deposit of the Holy Spirit in them too, and God's calling to the Muslims just like He's calling to you and me. So how do we want them to respond? You know, I mean that's, you know, and so I think that it's good to know that there's very, you know, the basic stories of Christianity. The basic stories of Judaism and Islam are very much the same. How they chose to handle conflict in some cases is different. And of course, we're quick to grab those scriptures out of the Quran to say that, and we tend to not say that too much about the scriptures in the Bible. But in the Bible, where you see extreme violence, it's always ordered by God. You know, so it's like we're not really taking responsibility. We're saying, well, either God did it, or God required me to do it for me to keep my status, you know. So it's very disarming to people to find that out. And when you this is one thing about visiting is that, you know, not only the Arab Christian issue, but also just getting to know Muslims. And so I've got to know several who, you know, they are as much interested in Jesus and what Jesus taught than any of us are. And I have a friend, I have a good friend who is an Adventist pastor in New York City. He was raised as a Muslim. And when he came to his faith, his Christianity, he did convert. But he says now when he goes and talks to his Muslim friends, he doesn't present it in a case of conversion in the sense of, you know, abandoning everything that you are and coming over here. But what he says is he says, if you really want to be the best Muslim possible, if you're really serious about being a good Muslim, then you need to understand what Jesus taught, okay? And then with the confidence, my friend Samir then has the confidence that God will take care of those details, you know? And of course, you know as well, and you know, probably already well aware of this, but the stumbling block for both the Christian, I mean, both the Jew and the Muslim really is the Trinity. It's the value that we place on Jesus. So you have a choice. Either you keep hammering on that and make the consequences of not acquiescing serious enough that, you know, and you just drive them apart. Or what I would suggest is that if you just build relationships with people, if you just, because I personally believe there's a deposit of God's Spirit in everybody. And this happened to me the first time probably 12 years ago, and I went to China with my friend the first time. And to be in a group of 35 or 40 people that I can't understand a word they're saying, but yet in your heart you know that you're on the same page, your spirits are on the same page. I can't explain it, except you can feel it. And that alone lets you know that God is much bigger than what we give him credit for. And I personally believe that the whole, you know, God is far more passionate about having us be one. I mean, one of Jesus' final prayers was that we would be one, that the body of Christ would win, that we would be one as they are one. So if we simply have the courage to extend ourselves, to allow ourselves to be vulnerable, to allow our faith to be vulnerable, I'm convinced that you'll hear that rushing mighty wind louder than you even heard on the day of Pentecost, because that's God's heart.
Tim, wow, I wish everybody could hear what you just said. And, you know, and just to reiterate, we're talking about the difference between, basically, we're right, you're wrong, to we have some things here that I think everyone needs to consider, and you have some wonderful things over there. Let's talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And look, here's where they connect up.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, if a person truly, like you're saying, is we're turning them on to looking into Jesus, they're going to eventually find out what Jesus said about who he is and what he came to be. And if the Holy Spirit is moving in their heart, they're going to get it. Truth mm-hmm. is truth.
Absolutely.
And the other approach has no possibility of any hope.
Yeah.
That should be obvious to everybody. Why is it so hard for people to see that, Tim? Why do you think
fear?
It's so hard for Christians
I think,
to be
I think
able
it's
to...
largely fear, and it's largely most people hold their positions about these things by default. They don't know any better. I would say it's ignorance. It's not ignorance in terms of being dumb, as being dumb people. It's ignorance in terms of lack of knowledge. I mean, just think of what happened. It just happened in the last, even 10 years when it's become more common to make short-term mission trips, you know, or go to other countries or be, you know, the ability, really, for a relatively small amount of money, we can go anywhere on the planet when you think of what you're doing. And that forced us to be exposed to people that we would have never been exposed to, or we would have been exposed to on our own terms. I know in our particular denomination, which is the Assemblies of God, I have friends that are involved in the Assemblies of God in Southeast Asia, for example, and there's been huge stress and tension in those circles because what's happened is that we've, you know, the traditional colonial mission era of the colonial missionary, in my view, is over. Okay? In saying that, I'm not saying it was wrong. Done. Okay? Huh. And but what has happened here is the traditional missionary work, and by that I mean the guy that packs up and goes and lives in the compound in the middle of Africa and has all the servants come in and take care of him. Basically he lives a good life. You know, in the middle there, and he's like the big guy. Now there was lots of seeds that were planted there, and there were seeds that are valuable. But what happens is these people now have risen up, and now you have people who came to faith when they were children, and now they want to lead. Okay, so how? Mm-hmm. So one of the big tensions is, and I again not to necessarily single out the AG, because I'm sure all denominational structures have this to some degree, but there's this idea is, okay, you know, are we going to impose on them to do things our way, or are we going to have the confidence to say, okay, God can speak to them just as well as he can speak to me? I mean, I remember going to other countries and saying to guys, you know, don't expect the Westerner to come here and tell you what you should do. You know, I mean, you hear from God just like I do. So my job, if I'm going to do my job to support you, whatever culture you're in, it's to be your cheerleader. It's to take your cheeks in my hand and say, I believe in you. I believe that the Holy Spirit that lives in you is the same one that lives in me, and he will tell you what's best for reaching your people. And my job is to support that. And in Asia, for example, you have a lot of people who, just like in our society, you know, whether we're a Christian or not, the basic Judeo-Christian value system is a part of our culture. You know, I mean, it's who we are. I mean, we don't lie. There's that ethos. Well, you now have people who have come to faith. Their basic structure is a Buddhist society. You know,
mm-hmm.
their basic structure mm-hmm. is maybe Hinduism, or even in this case of a Muslim society. So you can't undo, you know, people's culture. I mean, you can, depending on what kind of punishment you threaten them with, you might get them to conform certain ways, but you can't change who they are. So I think one of the challenges for Western Christians is, do we believe that God is big enough to use those people in their culture? And are we willing to release the reins enough and support them and be their cheerleaders and say, you go for it? Or are we going to say, no, you got to get back on our box because we're from North America and we call the shots? And so I think that's a real challenge. I think the beginning of the end, which this is really easy to say, but it's like, you know, once religion got in bed with power, you know, which really goes back to Constantine, because Constantine had this huge problem. I mean, he had to protect the interests of Rome. He had to somehow bring these Jesus followers under control, and then he had the Jews. Okay, so what better strategy than to create this thing? And so once you're able to marry religion or one's view of God with the empire, it's all over, because that's exactly what Islam does. That's exactly what all the world religions do to one degree or another. So
wow.
I think that's the whole nugget that Abraham came out of the wilderness with, was the concept of one God. I think this idea that there's only one God, and it's the God for everybody. And so anyway, I'm not sure all about that, but I just think that there's a dynamic there that we miss in being insecure and protective of our own. And getting out of Dodge is the first step.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing I'd say, Dodge is coming to us too. So we don't have to get out. We don't have to do much more than to go down to the convenience store now to be out of Dodge.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm hearing a lot of echoes of Oz Guinness, Gunner, aren't you?
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
This is so important. And Tim, do you ever get discouraged? Let me just tell you, I do. I get discouraged because I know that people's ideas about America and Christianity and all that stuff, it's just so ingrained in their worldview. They've spent their whole life believing this. I mean, you don't just change that overnight.
No.
Sometimes I just get real worried. What do we do? For the next generation, maybe.
Certainly the next generation is, I think, has a whole different approach to this.
Yeah.
I think that's why you see the evangelical numbers going through the floor in lots of places, or at least they're changing. They're changing their ethos. But I would say, it certainly can be discouraging. I think for me, it dawned on me. The seeds started planting about 10 years ago, but I'd say the last 5 years that I really have come to realize that I'm loved by God. Whatever happens with the church, whatever happens with the Middle East, whatever happens with my friends on Facebook, whether they understand or not, you know, or whether they believe me or not, I'm okay with God. So usually I've found the people that are the most vile in their responses are totally insecure, because that's what's causing them to be vile in the first place. They're protecting themselves. So if we really believed what we believed, we should be happy to sit down and talk to anybody and not feel threatened by it. So that has always kind of helped me. So it still is difficult at times. I probably get my biggest criticism from people that I've known the longest and should know me the best, and some of them do. They know my heart and they don't agree with me, and that's okay. I don't require that. I think everybody, to one degree or another, creates a box. They create their own theology about God. But I think the mistake is expecting everybody else to have your theology, you know, and to the point of divorcing yourself from relationships with them if they don't have your same worldview. That's the seed where evil thrives, because evil goes right in there, and then suddenly, because the body of Christ is really rendered impotent in the world. I mean, who would want to become a Christian? You know, seeing the way that we just treat people like Rob Bell and Driscoll and I mean, whoever you want to pick. I mean, you know, we eat our own wounded, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like, I mean, why would I want to join your club? You know, I mean, and why would a Muslim want to follow a God that they've been told seeks their destruction? There just doesn't seem to be, you know, doesn't seem to be any logic behind that. And so it is, but I think that, here's the other thing I would say about conversations and about, you know, Gunnar had mentioned about Facebook conversations. I came to realize with Facebook particularly that out of all of my friends, the majority of them are readers and not commenters. And I get comment affirmations from people regularly that I never even, never ever entered the conversation. So there's many people that read. And so one of the things that's been totally lost in this political correct society that we've developed, even inside the church, is we've lost the ability to talk about anything. I mean, we can't talk about racism. We can't talk about homosexuality. We can't talk about all this stuff, you know. And
yes.
But see, growing up, and not only growing up, but even now, the way you learn what you really believe is by having dialogue, by having push and pull and saying, okay, well, this is how I understand this, and somebody says this. And that's how you learn. But see, because we're so polarized, those conversations don't happen. So what I've found with one thing that keeps me willing to engage some of my more extreme conservative friends on Facebook,
mm-hmm.
for example, is
mm-hmm.
that I'm not so concerned about changing their point of view as much as I am providing for the reader the widest discussion points as possible, so that the Holy Spirit can drive into their heart what they need to think about and what they need to receive on. Because
yeah.
whether it's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, whether it's politics, whether it's police brutality, I mean, you have extremes on both sides that are never going to move. But the reality is that Shane Claiborne always calls it the radical middle. You know, is where it's where not only where Jesus is, but it's where the real future is. And so those
yes.
are the people that haven't quite poured their concrete around all their theology, maybe, or all their political views. And those are the ones that I don't even necessarily want to change them. I just wanted them to consider something else. And
that's great. Wow, this is really good. I hate to say that we're getting close to running out of time, but my goodness, this is,
well, let's do it
again sometime. So much. Yeah, we will. We'll have to do more of this because it's really what we want to teach our people. So I'm just so glad. But before you go, we have to talk at least a few minutes about Larry Norman. Come on. You and Larry were, I understand, are friends. We're friends.
Yeah.
Larry's with the Lord now and much happier,
yeah.
I'm sure.
I'm sure he is.
Yeah. Oh, my. Now, there's a controversial figure. And you want to just tell us really briefly about your relationship with Larry?
Of course, I was, you know, I was a fan and knew of him since, you know, early in the 70s. Seen him many times and taken pictures. I think the first time I saw him and photographed him was, he was at Reed College up here in Portland with Randy, and it must have been like maybe 71 or 72. And then later on he moved up to Salem, and so,
mm-hmm.
you know, we'd see him around town once in a while and all that kind of stuff. And but just in about the last 5 years of his life, he became friends of ours. And with a set of circumstances, we had a mutual friend up in Canada who had passed away, and he knew her. And so my wife and I were going up to her funeral, and so he brought some stuff. I'm going to send it to him and stuff. And, you know, he came, and of course, you know, and you probably relate to this well, too. It's like, you know, when you're in the entertainment business, you like, you don't go to bed. You know, I mean, everything's in the middle of the night, you know. So he'd show up at our house, and the first night we gave him directions and stuff, and he came and visited, and, you know, he ended up like staying till 4 in the morning, you know. It's just like, you know, it's like, you know, okay. And so it just kind of evolved, and what we all committed ourselves to, our kids and Christine and I, was to be Larry's friend, not to be his fan. I mean, I love his music and I love his heart, but it wasn't a fan kind of thing as much as it was to be his friend. Because I've really learned, the more well-known and even celebrity people are, the lonelier they are. And sometimes they don't know who is really their friend. You're really my friend because you really care about me, or you're my friend because of what you think I can do for you. You know, or those kinds of things. So we just really tried that. So over the next three or four years. I mean, he would probably come to our house, you know, every at least once a month, sometimes multiple times a month, just kind of come for dinner and hang out. And, you know, and we obviously talked. I did a couple of trips with him, went to Seattle with him one time, and just, you know, just kind of got to be his friend. I mean, you know, and I tried, you know, I tried hard, of course, you know, all the stuff that, that came down, and I've consciously stayed out of it. Simply because it, to me, it's not productive dialogue. Especially after someone's passed away. Especially after he's gone. You know, if this discussion, if this film, if this book doesn't lead us to some sort of wholeness, then I'm just not interested in being part of it. So
that's good.
But
yeah.
But he you know, I mean, I learned. He helped me learn a lot. I mean, I'll never. He was one of the first people to start talking to me about this concept that, that God loves you. You know, he told me that, you know, so most of his adult life that he was still trying to please God. And that it was so freeing to him to realize, you know, that God loved him. And if he never did another song, if he never did anything else, if he was okay with God. And so I learned a lot from him that way. And
That's great.
I mean, I got to be, I was actually with him the day before he passed away. Took him to Safeway in the wheelchair, and we not far from his house. And he was also a little bit like... So we always thought he was like the Velveteen Rabbit by this stage. Of course, you know, when he was young, he was like all those guys, and I'm sure he was young and cocky and, you know, ready to take on the world and the establishment and everybody. But by the time we got to know him, he was kind of like the Velveteen Rabbit, you know, and kind of had all his buttons worn off, and the fur was kind of thin. And so we just really, really learned to value him for who he was and what he did. And it was really a great thing. I really would consider it an honor to have had that opportunity.
That's great.
But
that's great.
I think he was definitely one of a kind.
Yeah. Apart from his persona, apart from the controversy surrounding him and everything, your knowledge of him as a person in these last couple of minutes, can you just for me describe what he was like to you as a person? How would you? If you just
here's my best Larry Norman story.
Larry
Norman and I went up to Seattle to view a screening of a movie, and at this by this stage his health is very, very bad, and he's got to take lots of medicine, and I had no idea that it was really this bad because I'd never been with him all night long, obviously, and so we went to this. To the screening of the film and talked to some people there, and you know went back to downtown Seattle and got a hotel room, and you know we didn't share a room, so he had his own room and I was next door. And literally the guy was awake all night, just you know hard breathed, just really in bad shape. We get up the next morning, we're headed back to Salem, and in typical Larry Norman, because also he suffered from diabetes really bad, and typical Larry Norman style, he says. He says to me, well, you know, I got to get something to eat in about 45 minutes or I'm going to die. Much like his shirt. So here we are right in downtown Seattle. We take the loop off the freeway and end up down underneath by where the ferries are. And we're like going through this parking lot there. And he sees this guy out, you know, kind of street guy, you know, kind of panhandling for some money. And Larry stops and talks to the person and just starts having a conversation with him. And I generally don't give those guys money. You know, I mean, I generally simply laugh if they want to get some food or, you know, but I generally don't just give out money. And so, and I, to be honest with you, I was a little bit in a hurry. I was driving him, and Larry wanted to talk to him. And so Larry goes and talks to him, ends up giving him, you know, $20 or something. I can't remember exactly what it was. And so then he says, well, I still got to get something to eat. So we take the guy over to Ivor's across the street. Okay, that's not, you know, middle of the road chowder house. You know, so we're sitting there having chowder. You know, of course, Larry's talking to this guy about music. And, of course, this guy doesn't know Larry from Adam. And you know, just it's an interesting thing. And so we end up going then down up into Seattle. We go into a pawn shop. Larry buys the guy a guitar. He helps him. He shows him some chords. I mean, the guy already was somewhat of a musician, and he had said that, and so that's how that kind of conversation started. He didn't have a guitar. So then we're already into this about 3 hours. And then we were supposed to head towards home, and then the guy says, well, where do we take him home? So the guy lives in Tacoma, which is like about 40 miles, 50
yeah.
miles south of Seattle. So we ended up taking the guy to his mom's house, and we ended up meeting his mom and everything. And it was just like, I mean, it was like, and then as soon as we got through with him, it was like Larry kind of then kicked back into being not feeling well, you know. So it was like, I can't explain, except it was just like, it showed me how big his heart was. And also the fact, it's like, I have another friend who was a pilot, and he was an old guy, and you would think, I'm not getting in a plane with this guy. You know, but when he got in the plane, it just kind of kicked into gear, and he could do it.
Yeah,
and that's kind
yeah,
of what it
yeah.
was with Larry. It was like, okay, this is I know what I'm supposed to do here, and that's what he was supposed to do, and that put any concern he had about his health at that point back to the back burner. You know, so
wow.
that really showed me because and having been with him the night before and knowing how much pain he really was in, and how much he was able to manage that. That just really
yeah.
heightened my respect for him totally. So yeah, I think that he was a great guy. I learned a long time ago when I was young that everybody has feet of clay. So I don't expect, you know, everybody to do everything right and but I'm not willing to throw them all under the bus because their clay feet show either. So
that's beautiful. Well, what a wonderful story. I appreciate that very much, Tim. And gosh, I just appreciate you having you on the show. This has been fantastic. We'll go back to
it. I appreciate it too, John.
And hopefully we can help. Maybe we do just a little bit to get people to think a little bit more open. And you know what
sure.
I'm going to learn from here is what you said about the love of God. If you believe God loves you, then you will be more secure. And able
mm-hmm.
to talk to other people and not have to force them to be the way you are.
Right. Absolutely.
That's wonderful.
That's 100%.
I
agree with you 100%. And also, I'll be obviously talking to Gunnar too, but, you know, if you ever want to, I can connect you with some Arab Christians and some Palestinians and some people working
wow.
around this issue. So you could talk to some of the real folks, not just me.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that would be great. So we'll do it some more, Tim. Thank you
okay,
so much.
Okay, perfect. Blessings.
This has been great. Love
Talk
you too.
Soon.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Whew. How about that?
Wow, that was great.
Yes.
That was really, yeah, that was great. That was like, we got to put that one right behind Oz. You got to listen to Oz, and then you got to...
Yes.
Got to listen to this because this is like taking what Oz says and like Marty always likes to say, this is boots on the ground.
Yes.
This is taking what he said and putting it into practice
yeah.
right in the world, you know.
Like life level application.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's BethlehemCoffee.org is that website.
Here we go.
And John, I just loved as, you know, we're just digging into that conversation. I think I heard you a few times, maybe pour another cup of that coffee.
You did.
I just thought it was this wonderful sound effect. It was just like, man, I want a cup of coffee like right now.
Yeah. Now, wait a minute. I just might have a little bit more. Hold on.
No.
Did you get it? Did you get it?
And so that pretty much means that you're going to be, as you said, you're in the entertainment world, so you pretty much never
yeah.
sleep. So that guarantees
well,
you'll be up all
I'm
night.
I'm going to pull a Larry Norman tonight, yeah. See, it all comes together.
It very much does come together. But
oh, gosh.
Great food for thought, and you're right. I think we need to put together a mashup between the Guinness. You know, here in the irony of that is like you're comparing the Guinness interview with this one with Gilman. Here we're talking about while we're having the interview, having a cup of coffee with Oz, we're having a pint of Guinness. And so
there you go.
There's something going on with beverages here, but hey, John, we've got a John, as we land the plane on this episode, if anybody's listening on the podcast here tonight, even here this next week, John, hey, guess what, John? We've got a question of the day, of the week, on the Facebook page, facebook.com/thecatch.
Yeah.
If you go there, if you're listening right now or this week, go there, and there's a post that says, "Let's build a playlist. What's your favorite Christmas song?" And we're getting all kinds of comments already. One of them I don't think I've heard yet. It's Porky Pig, Blue Blue Christmas. From David.
Well, I
David
think
Trump.
Somehow I feel like I might be able to do without that one.
Yeah.
Porky Pig and Blue Christmas. Well.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously, we invite, you know, get yourself a cup of coffee and add to the playlist at facebook.com/thecatch. But, John, what a great conversation. There was just so much in there that I think people really need to listen that can really challenge what we think and how we think, don't you think? think.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, my goodness. And I left. You know, he's great. He talks. I like he talks around stuff. He leaves us pictures, and then once in a while, I don't know if you noticed, but there would be like just this bong, this sledgehammer come down. You know, like for me, it was being loved by God. You know, I mean that was amazing. I wasn't even expecting that. You know that being loved by God would actually be put in context to conflict of, you know, between, you know, Christians and Arabs or Jews and Arabs. Being loved by God has something to say about that and the people who are the most angry are the ones who are the most insecure.
Mm.
I thought that was a very good point.
Yeah,
and the other point that stood out was the problem with a lot of people in America and why they are on this one page and can't seem to get off it is he said ignorance. I know what he meant. He meant actually we're just not really thinking for ourselves. We're letting other people do our thinking for us.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not taking the time to listen, to read, to say, is this really right? Is this the way I should feel about this? And you know, we've just got to turn that thing on. You know, everybody has a conscience. Everybody has something inside, that little lever that goes, I don't care if you're sitting and listening to Billy Graham. You know, if you're in church or whatever, and somebody says something and your beloved pastor says something and you go, I'm not so sure that's right. Well, then you better follow that. You better follow that and not just bury that and keep going because, oh, well, you know, he knows more than I do.
You're absolutely right.
We got to do better.
You're absolutely right. I mean, we've become this cut and paste generation. Right? We cut and paste what everyone else thinks on behalf of what we think. And, or, you know, this headline nation, we take it and run with it, you know, and you know, being able to wrestle with some things a little bit, you know, and being okay.
Yeah.
God is God, just good stuff. And again, BethlehemCoffee.org. If you're listening to the podcast,
there you go.
And send us a note. John, how can we? You know, if someone has questions from the show or has comments, what's the where they just post a comment on the website, or they can post? You can post something on our Facebook page. Let us know what you think.
Anywhere, either one, and let's not be. I love, you know what I love. Another thing I love him saying that we haven't poured concrete around ourselves yet. You know, we haven't pouring concrete around what you know our religion or what we believe. We've got to stay open. I thought it was really good. He said it took him about 5 years, to change his mind on certain things.
Mm.
And so that helped me because I get frustrated and I go, oh, these people will never change. Oh, no, we can change. Just stay open. That's what I say. That final word, my final word is stay open. Have a wide, stay open. That's it. You know, believe the truth. Commit yourself heavily to biblical truth, but stay open to the way that works in the real world and to what it really means. Because sometimes God can teach you directly out of the Word of God something that maybe you've never even heard before. So that's what we got to do. Great.
That's well, really good.
Are you going to land the plane or...
You know, I'm going to land the plane. And quite frankly, I was trying to land the plane with a Porky Pig's Blue Blue Christmas.
you didn't find it?
I couldn't find it. You know, I was trying to find it. But, you know, I think instead, I mean, we can come close to that, I guess. How's that? A little Elvis Presley.
Is that Elvis? Is that Elvis doing Blue Christmas?
The other small cake, right? Yeah, but
that's great.
little Elvis Presley. But John, let's land the plane. A great podcast tonight. We'll mash this one up with Oz Guinness. If you're listening, share this with your friends. Tell us what you think. Send us a comment. Go to Bethlehem.org, coffee.org. Order some coffee and pour a glass for John. And go to the Facebook page and tell us what your favorite Christmas song is, and we'll add that to the playlist. Until then, John.
All right.
We'll see you tomorrow morning. Catchjohnfisher.wordpress.com.
There you go.
To The Catch with John Fisher on Blog Talk Radio, connecting life to faith.
We're just trying to get it together, trying to help the fellow man. Hoping we can make it better. Do you really think we can?
Thanks, everybody. See you next time, John.
Hey, good, great show. Christmas tree.